Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. Thanks for tuning in and staying tuned in. If you're a new listener or you just stumbled upon us through a keyword search, this podcast is about tuning in. It's a resource that can help you make more informed decisions that can empower you to live healthier and a more connected life and in a sustainable way. If you've been listening to all 20 episodes so far, I hope you're experiencing the benefits of these conversations with these brilliant and thoughtful people out there doing the good work. The work that doesn't always get the recognition it deserves. My hope with each of these episodes is that to get down to the essence of the subject and that you might find a nugget or two or maybe more that can help you make better choices for the way you want to live and affect the kind of change you want to see in your own life and in the world. Because some of these people are actual colleagues of mine, I've even been using these episodes as a means of referral and networking so that my clients can preview the health practitioners I recommend or a subject or organization that I know a friend or family member might have an interest in. If there's an episode you think might benefit someone, all you have to do is hit the share symbol. It looks like a little box with an arrow pointing up, and you can email it or text it to them. This brings me to an email that I got from Cliff in California, who writes, "I really connected with your episode with Face It Foundation dealing with depression in men. I live in rural Northern California, and I wish there was a place like that here. I've struggled with depression on and off through my adult life and have a brother who has pretty severe PTSD from his time in Iraq and Afghanistan over a decade ago. I shared that episode with him, and he thanked me, said it made him realize he's needed someone to talk to, needs to be better about sharing what's going on, but doesn't want to burden people. I shared with him that I've been struggling too, and we decided to start meeting together once a week for coffee or to just talk about whatever we're going through. Thanks for doing this podcast. Really helped me change my thinking about some important things." Thanks, Cliff. Kind of getting choked up reading this one. I appreciate you listening and sharing the resource of this episode and for being a good brother. Sounds like you guys have figured out a good way to connect and help each other. My episode today is with Zeke Freeman, and it's a fun one. We're going to be talking about bees and honey. But before I get to that, I have to let you know that Highway to Health is now on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud. And I think that's it for now. So no matter how you're listening to or sharing these episodes, we're even easier to tune into. Also, isn't it nice to listen to these episodes without being told to buy something that you don't need or can't afford? Highway to Health is still ad-free, but I really do need your support. Each of these episodes takes me about 10 hours to produce, and I need the support. If you'd consider donating $5 to $10 a month, it will keep us from having to become reliant on sponsorship. You can go right now to patreon.com/highwaytohealth to donate. Also, don't forget, if you're a regular listener, subscribe to the feed on whatever app you're using so that we know you're listening. You can also subscribe to our Facebook page, Highway to Health Podcast, or our new Instagram feed, Highway to Health Blog, to stay tuned in and tuned up between episodes with insightful material curated by yours truly. One other thing, we're going to be launching our long-awaited website soon and are looking for written and video pieces, original content from people like you who are doing good work in the world and have something to share and say about your experience. You can email me your submissions directly at jeremy@highwaytohealthpodcast.com. Zeke Freeman of Bee Raw Honey will be joining me in just a minute. I had the idea of talking to him after my conversation with Luke Peterson a few months back. You may remember him. He's the regenerative farmer who reminded me of the complex ecosystem that our food comes from. And I realized that we didn't touch on bees and pollination and the critical process that was threatened a few years back as we saw our bee population dwindle. Zeke has been in the honey business for over a decade and knows a lot about bees, pollination, beekeeping, and why the populations of bees continue to struggle, and about how to harvest honey sustainably. With his background as a chef, he also shares his insights into using raw instead of processed honey and lets me sample each of Bee Raw Honey's varieties, which I enjoyed quite a bit. I had so much fun doing this with Zeke at at Bee Raw's office and warehouse in Industry City, Brooklyn. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Zeke Bruno. Where did you grow up?
Born in Seattle.
Oh, you were born in Seattle?
Yeah. Born in Seattle. Grew up in a little town outside of Seattle called Snohomish until I was age 8.
Okay.
Parents divorced. My mom became a professor at William & Mary College in Williamsburg, Virginia. Moved east. And she was a professor there for, I guess, until I was in about junior high. Junior high, beginning of high school. And then we moved to Northern Virginia, Alexandria, right outside of D.C. And that's where I went to high school. And then went to University of Montana. And then I went and spent...
Oh, you went back to Montana.
And I went back to Montana, yeah. I was like, well, got to go to college, so I might as well ski.
What was the... Oh, that's, was skiing the draw?
Skiing was the draw, yeah. You know, I had no idea what I wanted to do out of high school. I really did. I was always a terrible student. And at some point we can talk.
In what way?
I was a terrible student. Like, I was disengaged. I probably have some dyslexia. I have some undiagnosed dyslexia. I have some hyperactivity, executive function stuff that was never really diagnosed.
Totally.
And
me too.
I have an 8-year-old son who's going through all this stuff and like bringing up all these kind of emotions and stuff that is like crazy for me. Good news is, like, there's so much more out there.
I know.
Him.
No one. It was completely unrecognized when I think I had the same thing. I know I had reading challenges. I know, and I had a specific moment in my 20s where I think I started to self-diagnose a little bit, and I actually, you know, through books and whatever. I guess they were probably cassette tapes or something. But I taught myself how to meditate, you know, and you know, learning different ways of
Good
thinking about doing
it. I self-medicated in a whole different way.
I did some of that for a while, and the meditation came after. But the meditation, I think, rewired something for me. Like, it, I was able to actually like focus on things, and I think it made a huge.
I wish I had found it then, because you know it's probably only in the past 5 years that I found meditation and like the difference it is. But anyway, so yeah, university. So I wasn't a great student.
What was your major in Montana?
So I started as a business major, and typically in school, I was like, this is suck. It's all book work, and the professors are just blabbing at me, and that's not, you know, taking tests and horrible. So I left the business school and went to the food service management school, and that's when I started cooking. I had worked in restaurants all the time growing up in, you know, school, in, you know, after school, weekends, summers, all that stuff. And I always knew that I had an entrepreneurial streak. Like, I always was like, what's the business? What am I going to do?
You had plenty of energy with the ADHD.
Right. Oh, yeah, totally. Restaurants were good for me. And so I went to food service management, culinary school, and, you know, was totally engaged.
Was it there?
University of Montana. Really solid school, and finished my culinary school, and really didn't know what the next step was. I was like, well, Montana's not the place to, you know, grow a career.
Right.
You know, meat and potatoes place.
What city is it in?
Missoula.
Okay.
Awesome town. Fly fishing, skiing, mountain biking. I mean, it was an incredible place to go to school, and I would love to go back there and, you know, either retire there or have a summer place there. Like, amazing place to be. Great campus life, you know, and great off-campus life. It was just a really cool place to be and just beautiful all the time. I graduated from school and didn't know what to do, and my mom suggested I go visit an old family friend of ours who owned restaurants in Seattle. Old French dude, had owned restaurants in Seattle since like the 60s.
Yeah.
And Francois Kiesel. And I went to visit him. And he was like, so what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to be a chef. He's like, you want to be a chef? You are crazy. But if you want to be a chef, you have to go to France. And this is what I'm going to do. You're going to go stay in my house, in, you know, outside in Royan, which is, you know, on the Atlantic coast near Bordeaux. And you're going to go to my brother's language school and you're going to learn French. And then after a few months, you're going to go to Grenoble, where my other brother, he runs the hotel school in Grenoble, and you're going to cook with him, and then they're going to send you out to restaurants. And so that's exactly what it is. So for 2 years,
it's amazing.
I went to Royan, and this like beautiful little small town on the Atlantic coast, just north of Bordeaux on the Gironde estuary. And during the day I went to, you know, school with like all these like fun kids. And most of them were like from, yeah, there was kids from Morocco and Iraq and Japan and China and Hong Kong, like they'd all come to school there to learn French. And then they were going to French, like college, French university.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I was like the guy who's like, woohoo, like not a serious student.
Yeah, yeah.
I was there to like learn French and culture and stuff. So they were home studying and I was like out with the French people. And so they all came in and knew all their like vocabulary and knew all their grammar. And I came in like, could talk. Yeah, and they were like, why is your French getting so good? I was like, because I'm hanging out with the French people drinking wine. So I went to school during the day, and weekends and evenings I'd travel around all the Bordeaux regions and drank cognac and Bordeaux's, and you know, that was my like introduction to like French culture and that's wine and food outside of Montana.
So were you like right out of college, like 23 years old?
22 years old.
It's perfect.
It was amazing. So I left there, went to the hotel school of Grenoble where Francois's brother was, and I spent about 6 months there, and that was really rough because this was like, you know, they were kids. These were not college students.
Yeah.
These were what they call college. And these were like 14 to like 18 year olds.
Yeah.
You know, it was like junior high through high school. And, you know, I'm this 22 year old, like, you know, and they are wicked rigid about their rules in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Like, this is how it's done. And that's how they learn. Like, there's no kind of like in school there. And even in the beginning cooking stages, like there's no room for like interpretation, free form art. No. There's none of that. Yeah. It is very recipe technique specific. And so, you know, they're like, who are you? You don't know what you're doing. You don't even know how to make a pat brise, you know, like what's a pat brise? I've seen a pie crust.
Yeah.
So that was tough. And then it kind of continued for my first couple of, you know, internships. I'd walk in and they'd put me with this like 14 year old, you know, intern, you know, who, you know, was there, you know, he went to school, you know, French culinary school during the day. And at night, like he was there cooking and like, he was the one in charge of me. And I'm like, this is kind of weird, really hard, very humiliating, but I learned a ton. Yeah. You know, learned a ton. And then
it's a good way to get your ego in check. And like,
I
spent a little time in Oxford for college and even, same, you know, just like an old, it's an old way of the structure of schooling. It's all about, you know, what came before. And so you have to follow these rules, and you have to like, it's like a belief system that you have to like, you know, really just let yourself get into.
It's not all bad.
No, it's not either.
You know, I mean, God knows we should still be teaching Latin, people.
Yeah. 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 And sometimes, you know, these, I think we've lost a little bit of that in our culture. Like,
for sure.
Now, you know, everybody who has a microphone can do a podcast.
My daughter came home the other day and she was like, oh, I really like this song. I don't remember what it was, some pop song. I really like this song. I was like, oh, where'd you hear it? And she's like, oh, this has been our like, you know, end of day pack up song for the past like 5 days. So like every day the teacher puts on a song that they get to like dance around to while they're packing up their bags. It's like, you guys have way more fun than we did in school. Like, it was not like that when we were in school, and there was no choice time.
No, there was no choice time at all. Oh, wow. So did you work over there at all?
Yeah.
Then,
so I went, my first stage was in this, small restaurant, 1-star Michelin restaurant outside of Lyon. And really like sweet older chef, had been, you know, running the place for like 20 years. I learned a lot there and, you know, met some really solid people there. And then I got sent down to Monaco in the summer, and the school
sent down there as like, was it punishment or
no,
something?
No, it wasn't a punishment. It was just like, okay, here's your next stage. Like, okay, this is the next thing. And so they sent me to to Monaco, and the whole, all of Monaco is owned by the prince. Yeah. Principality.
Yeah.
And there's a company called the Société de Bains de Mer, and they own all the hotels and all the clubs and basically everything, the casino, they own everything.
Yeah.
And they sent me to the Monaco Beach Club, which was like, only, it was a seasonal restaurant right on the beach in Monaco. you know, super, super luxe and rich and all that stuff. And I was in like the fast food restaurant at that hotel. And it was like, you know, fast food from French standards, right. You know, but right. it really was like,
is it like bistro type?
Yeah. Bistro. Yeah, exactly. So like, you know, veal chops and, you know, salmon salads and niçoise and French classics and basics. But it was like, okay, so I did the summer there and it was solid and, you know, very high volume and not so much fun, kind of grungy kitchen, totally different from this experience, but good practice, totally solid. And, you know, I was like, I want something next. And they actually had a dorm for all the seasonal employees. And the guy next to me was like, he was working at Alan Ducasse's restaurant, the Louis the 15th. And he's like, you know, you should go talk to him, like come up there and, you know, talk to him, see, you know, maybe you can get a stage. Like, what the heck? You know, you speak French and you've cooked now for a while. Like,
you were in Montana 2 years ago. And then what do you got to lose?
Exactly. What do you have to lose? Going to go back to Montana? So, you know, he gets me, you know, an introduction. I go in, I meet like the assistant. The assistant introduced me, like, send me in to see Alan Ducasse. And, you know, he speaks to me a little bit. He's like, your French is okay. What have you done? You know, I would hardly call it an interview. And he's like, well, look, if you're willing to stay for a year, you can start tomorrow. And I was like, how about 8 months?
You negotiated on the spot.
I negotiated. What was I going to do? Like, I'd already been here for 2 years. Like, my, you know, my mom was paying my way. You know, I didn't have any money. Like, I totally felt bad about it.
Were you kind of ready to go at that point? Or?
I wasn't ready to go. By no means was I ready to go, but I also didn't have any money. Yeah, and, you know, my mom was kind of like, you know, how long is this going to go on? And she wasn't prepared for a year commitment.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, I had to kind of negotiate. So I was like, look, I got 8 months. It's better than a year, right? So there you go. Next day I started the Louis the 15th and almost the same thing as like the 14-year-old, like grabbing by the scruff of the neck, except it was like 25-year-old, like hulky dude, like, you know, rugby nose, scar on his face. And he's like, viens avec moi. Come with me. He takes me in and like hands me, you know, some salad, some lettuces and like here, like this. And that's what I did practically for the morning and for the next like 3 weeks was like pick this little salad greens and made the mise en place for like what they called le grand salade. This like giant salad that had like truffles on it and all kinds of crazy different wild lettuces and all kinds of good stuff. Yeah. It was wild.
And you can't say, you can't like, with a guy like that, you can't really say no to anything.
You don't say no. You say yes. We chef.
Is it like the military in some way?
Very, very militant. Wow. I mean, like every, so we did approximately 80 dinners at night and about 40 during at lunch. And you worked both shifts and you got there at like, you know, 8 a.m. did all your mise en place in the morning, did the service. And between each service, you cleaned the kitchen like it was an operating room.
Yeah.
Like an operating room. I mean, the floors, the gaskets around the refrigerator, inside the drawers, everything. I mean, everything got put away, perfectly marked, dated, et cetera, et cetera. And then you came back and did it that evening again.
They didn't need the New York City letter grade system to
literally every vertical surface got stainless steel polish. Wow. Every horizontal surface got, you know, Windexed. I mean, operating room, no fingerprints, nothing. And
that's amazing.
And the last thing that happened at the very end is the bottom person in each kind of group, you know, ran a bucket of, you know, threw a bucket of water down, mopped the whole thing. Everyone left, squeegeed it, and you walked out. It was nuts.
Wow.
Nuts. So yeah, that was France. That was crazy.
So you did your 8 months?
I did my 8 months. And again, you know, I kind of didn't know what I was going to do next. Went to talk to the chef. I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, it's like, you should probably go to New York. Like, New York's your next stop. Yeah. Like, what else are you going to do?
I think Missoula would be a good place.
Missoula would be a good choice. You should head back to, you should head back to Mountains Kids. You've really, got no really future. So that's kind of what happens. I had one interview outside of New York, which was at the Inn at Little Washington, which is this amazing little bed and breakfast. It's a pretty famous hotel outside of DC, about 2 hours down the Shenandoah Valley. Gorgeous, gorgeous place. But then I came to New York, checked out Le Cirque.
What year is this?
98, 99.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. 98, 99. Went to, I guess it wasn't the original Le Cirque. Le Cirque had just opened in whatever it was, the big space that it was in. Danielle had just opened his his second restaurant. And he had been at Le Cirque at the original restaurant. So those were the two, I think I went to. Maybe I also went to La Bernardin. But Danielle and I, like, we hit it off well. And then I got in there. And we were doing like 400 meals a day. And, you know, this was like,
were you specializing at this point for him?
I really wasn't. You know, there's some time that goes in before you really get into a specialization. Okay. You know, my skills were still pretty generalized. I'd seen a pretty decent amount of everything. Certainly my bent was then and still is like meat. I can cook some meat.
Yeah.
I can cook some meat. you know, but we were doing like 400 covers a day, a meal, like, or maybe it was a day, but it was a huge leap.
Yeah.
Same number of cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Same number of people in the dining room and three times the number of meals.
Yeah.
And this was a restaurant that was supposed to be as high end and high quality. And I was just totally turned off by it. I was totally turned off by the volume, by the quality, by how they ran the kitchen. You know, like, it would not run like a French kitchen and like, okay, this is how you do it. And, you know, I had been freaking militantly trained at this point. Like, okay, this is how you do stuff. And they'd show you how to do it and you do it and they'd look over your shoulder and fix it. And you look over your shoulder until you got it right. And it was right every time. And it never changed. You know, there wasn't, and you know, at this restaurant now, it was like, you know, okay, really important client, like, make it good.
Yeah.
And I was like, what do you mean? Isn't it all supposed to be like just so? And it wasn't. You know, and I was totally turned off by the whole situation. It was very high pressure, but like, the love wasn't there for me. So
within, that's tough.
Within 8 months, burnt out, and I was out of there. I was like, I'm not doing this. This is not what I'm going to do. I went and visited a couple other restaurants looking to see, like, you know, if there was something else that was a good fit. Nothing felt right. Like, I was totally burnt and like tail between my legs, not in a good spot. And, you know, I was like, I'm not going back to a restaurant. So I left, walked out.
You stayed in New York?
Stayed in New York. I had a girlfriend at that point and was living with her. And I kind of like walked the city for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell am I gonna do?
Walkabout?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, the entrepreneurial stuff started percolating again. Yeah. Like, what did I want to do? And I was thinking about like this cooking school book, you know, shop type of place. And yeah, you know, I didn't have any money. But I walked into Dino DeLuca one day.
Hmm.
And I was like, huh, seems like, you know, this has got the, you know, it's refined and
it's clean.
It's super clean and it's got a clean look. And, you know, like it's got a lot of the things that I can imagine doing from an entrepreneurial standpoint. Yeah. This seems like it could work out. So, you know, I went in, I applied for a job. I got a, you know, assistant manager's role pretty easily. And, you know, ended up spending the next like 6 or 8 years there, moving up the food chain. In different roles, different purchasing roles, different managerial roles. And, you know, spent the last couple of years there as the head merchandiser who was in charge of buying all of the, selecting and purchasing everything for the catalog and the stores.
So you really got way behind the scenes pretty fast.
Very, yeah. I mean, I had a pretty deep food knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
And a pretty natural managerial knowledge.
And did they see that just from your experience working and being in Europe? Maybe was that a big?
I think that was a big part of it. And, you know, look, I'm not a shrinking violet. Never yeah, was. Yeah. You know, it's like I always move in from the time I was 15 years old and working, yeah. I always moved into some sort of managerial yeah, role yeah. very quickly. Yeah. You know, I just, you know, I don't support crap. Like I can't
you don't like to take orders from 14-year-olds.
I don't like to take, yeah, that was really hard for me. Like
I could imagine.
There was no space for that because as soon as I saw that, like there was a better way to do it, that's the way I wanted to do yeah. it. Yeah. Even though that wasn't the way they did it.
Yeah. What was the first entrepreneurial thing that you dug into then?
So the first real one in my adult life at that point, because I had mowed lawns, I had like done
oh, yeah.
everything possible, yep. you know, on that scale when I was a kid. But my first adult one was when I was at Dean DeLuca. I met this young Italian woman who was the daughter of an olive oil producer in Sicily. And she was at Columbia University finishing her graduate degree and about to leave. And we fell in love. And we decided to go open like a bed and breakfast agritourism in Sicily. And so I left Dean DeLuca. And now I don't know what year we're in. I guess we're in the mid-2000s.
Oh.
And left Dean DeLuca, and we went to Sicily and started working on this bed and breakfast agriturismo stuff. I had, you know, a bunch of, I had been practicing yoga for several years at that point, and I had a couple of yoga teachers that, you know, I got kind of on board to come bring groups immediately. So we had several yoga retreats right away, and yeah, just spent a bunch of time like doing kind of what I did in France, or what I would have really loved to do in France,
yeah.
you know, really kind of turning that on and learning the Italian cuisine, really Sicilian cuisine, and, you know, teaching people about it. And that was totally hot for me. That was just like the best, because I got to take all of this knowledge that I gained at Dean DeLuca in terms of food knowledge, turn it on, you know, dial it into a specific culture, and then, you know, hand deliver it to people.
That's awesome.
And that was just a ball. I really enjoyed my time there. And yeah, so I got to be kind of this brand manager for this amazing olive oil, really well-known olive oil company, and develop this really beautiful thing. And so the relationship didn't work out in the long term.
Yeah.
So that ended. But, you know, what I got out of that was kind of, you know, breaking the seal on, okay, I can do entrepreneurship. I can do the next
thing.
You
saw enough behind the scenes too that you could kind of like
I got so much from Dean DeLuca, and I got so much confidence from what I did in Sicily that I was like, you know, when I came back to New York, even though like my heart was broken from the relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like my I was like, I wasn't going looking for a job.
Right.
I did not look for a job.
Yeah.
You know, I just didn't. It wasn't even like on my radar. So what did happen was something where the seeds had been planted several years earlier at Dean DeLuca is one of the great things about the job at Dean DeLuca was that it was one of the best known destinations. If you had a new food product, Dean DeLuca was the stop.
Yeah,
like you go
yeah.
to New York and you present your product for Dean DeLuca. And so I had people, you know, 5, 6, 10 people a week knock on my office door and yeah. say, wouldn't you like to try my such and such, you know, everyone's tried it and they think it's the greatest thing.
Yeah.
Greatest thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, 99% of those products were absolute schlock. And I, you know, do my best to say,
absolutely.
Like, look, this
yeah.
is, I love where you're going. I love your heart. You know, I appreciate that's where it's from, but you know, either the packaging isn't there or the product isn't there or the ingredients aren't clean enough. et cetera, et cetera. And I'd do my best to be, you know, as diplomatic as I could about, you know, turning them down and giving them some good critical point of view and direction. And so one day this young lady comes in and, you know, she was quite attractive and relatively interesting, kind of hippie-ish. And she had these vials of honey. And she said, well, you know, I'm an artist and, you know, I've been painting and, you know, I got these vials of honey from, you know, my friend upstate. And, you know, he introduced me to this other beekeeper over here and he gave me these honeys and mm-hmm. I put them in these pretty vials and I put these vials in this cute little block and isn't it cute? And wouldn't you like to sell it? And it was a very unfinished product.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but the idea was really interesting. And I was like, wow, that's a really beautiful presentation. And so what ended up happening is I ended up kind of consulting with her, developing a retail package around the whole line, these vials, which are now what we call honey flights, and then creating the jars that you see in front of you that are inspired by, like, you know, USDA generic packaging, you know, from like early 40s and 50s.
Yeah, I like it.
That, you know, just says, hey, this is raw honey, and then lets the honey inside the jar speak for itself. You get all these different colors and textures and flavors that are based on the floral source. But anyway, so she brings me this product. I help her develop the product line around it and become her first customer while I'm at Dina De Luca. I leave, I go to Sicily. She actually comes with one of the yoga retreats. She's like, oh, I don't know how it's going. You know, we've had some success and, you know, Oprah wrote about us and Martha Stewart, you know, mm-hmm. had us, but like, I don't know what the heck I'm doing. I can't manage it. I've put a bunch of money into it. I said, no, you'll be fine. You know, you're doing great. Just keep at it. You'll be fine. When I come back to the US, look her up. And like I said, I wasn't looking for a job, but, you know, see how you're doing. She's like, I'm closing down the business.
Hmm.
What do you mean you're closing that business? Like, you know, it's going great. You know, it's fine. You know, it's just like, I don't know what I'm doing. Can't manage it. I've hired a manager. They're costing me too much money.
Yeah.
So on and so forth. And I was just like, well, let's make a deal. And so for kind of a no cash deal, I took over the business. She kept a small percentage. And, you know, I already knew my way around this business.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of knew the product. My heart was in the product. You know, I knew the story of the design and the packaging and everything that kind of went around it. You had
the connections in the food industry already.
My connections in the food industry. And so that was 12 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, I made a couple of changes to the business. And, you know, she had kind of gone outside of the U.S. and started importing Manuka honey from New Zealand and lavender honey from France. And, you know, this was not so long after, you know, this was kind of, you know, post Gulf War and like that period of time. So it was very like, you couldn't even say French fries at that point, right? Like it was all about freedom fries. So not that that's an excuse, but you know, there was kind of that mentality. So I was like, let's focus on US producers.
Yeah.
And to give you some of my backstory is why that was so important to me, besides just the, you know, that reasoning was that, you know, I grew up spending my summers on my family farm.
Yeah.
So
I was wondering, like, I mean, I felt like I knew there was a connection, but just because I know about this family farm.
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up spending all my summers, you know, on the farm that my grandfather grew up
on. Where
is
it again? It's in
Erie, Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. Yeah.
Right on Lake Erie. My mom grew up, you know, running a tractor in the summers.
Yeah.
My aunt, my cousins, you know, I probably spent the most time there of my cousins, but, you know, I saw, one, how hard it was for a family farm to, like, how much work that goes in, you know, day in and day out, 9 months of the year. And then two, the amazing effect, the amazing outcome, the product
of
fresh produce.
Yeah.
Was
my summers were similar. I think, I don't know if I told you this before, but I went to Iowa every summer. Same thing. I mean, I wasn't the whole summer, but I'd spend a month down there every year. And, you know, be around the farms and, you know, everything is just, you know,
when you eat like sweet corn out of the field for the first time, like raw, freshly picked. And it's like, candy.
Even when you're digging like radishes and carrots out of a garden, it's just like, you know, and I remember as a kid sometimes digging stuff out and like just wiping it off enough to like, I wanted to eat it right there with the dirt and like kind of dealing with it,
right? Absolutely. So I had these two things, you know, in my, you know, one, I really understood how hard these guys worked.
Yeah.
And two, I really understood, you know, I had such a strong feeling for how good it was and how important it was to me that, you know, I had that same feeling immediately once I started getting to know the business of beekeeping and making honey.
How did you learn? Did you spend time around
just
them?
Dug in. Yeah. Just started spending time with the beekeepers, and that's how we found other US beekeepers. Is, you know, it's a very close knit community.
Yeah.
And the good beekeepers know other good beekeepers who have really solid practices. And that's how we kind of built our network of great producers.
I just talked to this, a guy who does regenerative farming. Is there something in the way that honey is produced that has that, where you're trying to, I mean, you obviously need to keep the bees or, you know, around an area, but you know, some aspect of the honey is for them. Right. And then, you know,
So let's back up. Let's go to like eighth grade science, right? Like eighth grade life science here. So bees live in a colony. That colony runs on the core of a queen bee. Mm-hmm. The queen bee's job is to lay eggs.
Okay.
And those eggs are fed by what's called a royal jelly, which is kind of like she's fed with a royal jelly, which is kind of a concentrated honey that has like 10, 20 times more energy than regular honey.
Hmm.
But what bees do is they go out, they send out little worker bees to kind of patrol, mm-hmm. and they find a good, good nectar source. And nectar is their food of choice. It's like having fresh fruit. And, you know, they eat that, and then they also make a preserve out of that.
Is each nectar source, like, dependent on, like, the palate of the queen bee? Like,
the nectar source is based on the flower, what flower is available.
Okay.
So they go out there, and whatever is blooming at that moment.
Oh, gotcha.
You know, because flowers kind of more or less bloom at the same time, yeah. right? Depending on the different type of flower, they kind of bloom it all at the same time. So whatever's blooming strong at that certain time, the bees go out, they're collecting nectar from that specific floral source, mm-hmm. they bring it back, and they are making their food for winter. This is the original green beans, gotcha. Or canned strawberries, or your, you know, raspberry preserve, right? Yeah. This is the original preserve. So they take the fresh nectar, they essentially digest it a little bit to kind of create a preserved,
condensed version,
exactly, and that's honey. That's what we know as honey. And that honey is changed based on the nectar of the flower. So for us, in all these jars you see in front of you, each one of these
different colors
is a different floral source. So we have, you know, clover and sourwood and meadow foam and tupelo, and all these are different floral sources. So we actually take our bees and we place them near one of those floral sources before it blooms, and the bees collect the nectar from that specific floral source and the pollen. You'll remember all the little hairs in their legs. They also have the pollen on it. And the nectar and that pollen affect the flavor, texture, and color of the honey. And it changes dramatically from one to the next. So, you know, this was really attractive to me. It's like, there, you know, as a chef, I'm like, this is a whole new, like, spice cupboard.
Yeah, totally.
Of, you know, flavors to, like, play with.
Yeah.
So as a chef, that was super interesting. As a, you know, grandchild of a farmer, I was like, wow, these beekeepers have to work so hard to do this.
Yeah.
That, like, let's focus on, like, our American and local beekeepers. Like, let's do this. Like, let's focus on these guys.
What year is this? When are you starting to do this?
We're talking 2005, 2006. Okay. I took over the business. And so, you know, I don't know if you remember, you know, you remember that far back in terms of, you know, the food business, but like gourmet and cheese and all that stuff was really just getting kicked off.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't nearly as, you know, big a deal as it is today. And, you know, now I would say things are kind of gourmet washed and that it's kind of everywhere all the time, which is not bad. It's a good thing. People are really paying attention to what they're eating now.
Yeah.
Whereas at that point, it was still like a specialty food. It was still gourmet.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's almost expected, which is great. But we were really kind of in the forefront of thinking about what is important in terms of producing a product, mm-hmm. and what makes it different and unique and sustainable and something that has an effect on the environment as well as on people.
Yeah.
And still drives us.
Yeah. And so tell me about the sustainable part. Because I've been on your newsletter for a while, mm-hmm. and I see different things that come in. You got, and because you started a nonprofit that's part of B Raw,
right?
You've put a lot of detail into, the honey that you're getting is the surplus for what the bees need. I don't understand that process. So how to explain that part of it?
Right. So beekeeping itself is, and the process of collecting honey is a little bit, it's kind of trickery to some extent, in terms of how we get bees to,
because you got
to
get it from them somehow.
You have to get it from them, but more than that, you have to get it from them and there be some left over, right?
Right.
And so if there were and for the most part now, like, honeybees are not a wild creature. They are pretty much kept. Right. I wouldn't say they're domesticized.
Yeah.
But they are pretty much kept. They don't survive any longer in the wild.
Oh, wow.
They've been kept for an eon, and most of what is kept are European honeybees or Italian honeybees, and
in the States,
worldwide.
Okay,
worldwide. There are some breeds that are Russian. There's also killer bees. African bees. They're all related, but European Italian honeybees are the most docile,
okay,
and produce the most honey.
Oh.
So they're the ones that are most often kept. So if they just had a hive, once they filled it up, they'd be like, okay, I'm done. We're full. We've got enough honey for the winter.
And they wouldn't continue to work.
They wouldn't continue to really work. They wouldn't have to fill that pantry, right, for the winter. So beekeepers, what they do is they add on. They put an addition, essentially, on the hive.
There's a portion that they know. There's some equation probably, right, of how much you can take of that,
sure,
to keep them.
Yeah, so there's a bottom box, which is called the super, and that gets filled up. And so there's one of them that is where all of the breeding happens, where the babies are laid and, is completely separate. Then there's the second one, which is the first honey super, which, is becomes the food stores for the bees. And then you stack on top of that and the bees fill as they go up. And, you can have four or five boxes high, and the ones on top are the ones you can take and leave, enough honey behind for the bees for the winter state.
Okay.
So, that's not to say that that's what everyone does.
Right. Right. Of course.
And I think that that's what you're alluding to is,
I know within say the vegan community, mm-hmm. that has become an issue of if you're choosing not to eat anything and any animal products, and that eating honey is one of those things that's like a no-no in the vegan community. If there's a sustainable way of keeping those bees and more bees happening by having them be involved,
right,
if they're kept, I'm wondering how you address
vegans
that.
Vegans are funny because at the end of the day, honey isn't so much different from milk, right? You're not going to convince a vegan to start eating dairy.
You're right.
So there's the one part that's the dietary.
Right.
And then there's the other part of it. It's like, the social part, the part about, is this a humane way to treat an animal?
Right.
Right. And that's a different topic. So, from that point of view, that part we can change. We can't change the part that it's still an animal product.
But let's say because the farmer that I talked with recently was telling me that in order for him to close the chain on and do regenerative farming, he needs to have animals on his farm.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
And so, because that is one way to create sustainability.
Sure.
And really the, you know, at this point, the only way to not have to deal with like sourcing petrol to get his stuff shipped to him or getting it sure. from a supplier or getting manure from a supplier.
And you know, ideally he probably has bees. Like if he keeps tomatoes
oh, yeah. of
or
course
strawberries
he does. Yeah.
or broccoli, like all of those crops will benefit from right. having bees who are pollinating them. They will increase the yield of what he's getting
yeah.
and everything will grow better.
Or what he's growing that can attract the bees in the first
right.
place.
That's yeah. right.
So, you know, I'm curious just because part of what I'm trying to kind of dig into in the podcast happens to, you know, while I'm talking about health and looking at what this balancing act is, I'm going beyond healthcare
yep.
to what is this balancing
what
act?
What are the inputs?
Yeah.
And what are the inputs? What are the things that we can control that we put in our body every day?
Right.
Other than medicine.
Right.
What is our daily dose of what makes what's good for us?
Yeah.
And how is it produced and how can we produce it well? That's better for the environment so that we all live better.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that makes sense.
That's part of it. And knowing that like honey has been used for eons as a you know, an elixir of sorts for all sorts of things.
Oh my God. I mean, you could talk about like, we could spend a podcast on that alone, right?
Is that right?
Like, yeah. I mean, you know, it's antiseptic. You can put it on burns and cuts and they will heal better. If you, you know, suffer from things like rosacea or any sort of skin things, like, yeah. you know, I get some like weird skin stuff in the winter, you know, and you put honey on it and it just clears right up, you know, even just dry skin, it's a humidicant. Oh, so it actually pulls moisture into it. It softens and moisturizes your skin. It's astounding. You know, as you know, it's the base to my sports drink because, you know, a teaspoon of sugar, you know, it has 60 calories in it, mm-hmm. a squeeze of lemon, a pinch of salt, and you've got an incredible like recovery drink, you know, in a liter of water that, you know, crushes coconut right. water and is next to free.
And the
there's
thing
so,
that
there's so much beneficial.
It's an unprocessed thing, which is the thing that I'm starting to become more interested in, you know, having this conversation with this farmer recently about, you know, the soil itself and that, you know, there's all this fungi and bacteria and this good stuff that actually is in the soil that comes through those plant roots into the plant or into the flower that the bee is then, you know, cultivating as well. I've been kind of minimizing my animal, mostly, especially the ones that I think are
big animals,
the big animals, because there are some environmental issues around that.
Some.
And we need to kind of be considerate of some of those yeah. things. At the same time, like I'm always working for myself, trying to figure out what is this balancing act. I also want to like stay healthy enough to raise my children.
Yeah, so, absolutely. You know, and you also want to enjoy life. And you know, look, beef is good, tastes great,
right?
You know, right. and you know, you can do everything you want to, you know, go with grass fed, et cetera, and do the best you can to make it good for you as well as good for the planet. But at the end of the day, like it's a big animal
yeah.
who produces a ton of carbon dioxide
yeah.
and just is not good for the environment.
Yeah.
I mean,
especially since they're growing in California and they need so much water.
Yeah. They consume tons of water, tons of food, produce tons of carbon dioxide. And it's really, and that's not even getting into the industry of bee farming.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's
well, and then bees also serve this other the pollination process, yeah. which is a whole other aspect of bees that we know. I mean, I think it wasn't even being discussed in 2005. They
absolutely not.
This is kind of a maybe last 5 years type of topic,
right?
But,
and so that's that you were talking about. You mentioned our foundation, the Bee Raw Save the Bees Fund, and so. I guess it's been even a bit longer than 5 years now. I guess it's been about 7 years. We had a really significant bee die-off, and bees were disappearing left and right. And it was, you know, front page news in a lot of places.
Yeah.
And it was this big question mark, like what's happening with the bees? Bees are dying off. What's going on? What the heck is happening? And people were like, it's cell phones and it's, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff, you know, coming out.
What did your bee farmers say at that point?
At the very beginning, they really didn't know. I mean, they really didn't have any idea. And, you know, we had a bit of a business crisis at that point, because we had, you know, a couple of beekeepers who didn't have any production for, you know, a year. And it, you know, put us in some dire straits in terms of, you know, fulfilling our customers' requests. But what came to be found out pretty quickly was that, you know, it wasn't any one thing.
Right.
It was a whole bunch of inputs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we know more, and I think what I, you know, definitely know, really feel really strongly now is that, you know, it is true across our entire food system. And what has happened with the bees is endemic across our food system.
Yeah.
And let me explain to you basically what happens in beekeeping and pollination, industry-wide for the most part in the United States. Is today honey is not what beekeepers make money on. They make money from pollination. And the same as, you know, family farmers have dwindled and dwindled, and farms have become bigger and bigger and producing more and more, beekeeping has become the same way.
So by pollination, you mean like the service part of?
The service part of pollination. Literally, the beekeepers are now managing thousands of hives.
Yeah.
They're putting them on trucks. They're trucking them across the country to blueberry farms in Maine almond groves in California. Peppers in the South, and they move them all around the country all year long following these crops. And when I say they, like, load them by the thousands onto the backs of trucks, truck them across the country, you know, drop them in an almond field, you know, before there's any almond flowers blooming. You know, once upon a time, there was natural flora blooming all around an almond field. But today, in farms, it's all about yield. So every square inch that can be plowed under around that field has been plowed under to make sure that, you know, that those weeds, quote unquote,
right,
are not taking any nutrients from the soil and not pulling any moisture from the soil. And those almonds will yield as much as possible. There's no natural flora around.
Right.
So they drop them in these, you know, wastelands of almond trees that aren't blooming yet, feed them sugar water for a week to 10 days until the almond trees start blooming. Because the process is all about maximum yield, the more flowers that are pollinated, the more fruit that gets born, right? So they put 4 to 5 times as many bees in the almond grove that is even necessary. So there's not enough food.
So
not enough food from that almond to even feed the bees that are there. So they're fed more sugar water. Literally corn syrup. I mean, we're talking about like corn syrup and water.
In like a little...
In a bottle. Literally in a bottle stuck in the top of the hive. Drips in there, and that's the food. And then the almond bloom stops, and the bees are sitting there still, you know, in the sun, no natural flora around them, and they are fed more sugar water. So, you know, just this one little space, they've been trucked across the country, fed sugar water, you know.
For this just minute period of time to deal with the bloom.
Right. So look, that's not bad. Pollinating almonds is bad. But the whole process of how we're treating. So what kind of health condition would you be in had you been fed corn syrup for 3 weeks to a month?
Right.
Right? You're immunosuppressed.
It's like
you're malnourished and immunosuppressed.
Yeah.
So of course a pesticide's going to kill your whole hive and all the hives around you.
Yeah.
Just the littlest touch of a pesticide,
right?
Even if it was just like a whiff, a breath blowing in the wind, you know, you're immunosuppressed.
Yeah.
You're malnourished. You're weak as could be. The bee's version of the common cold. You know, everything is now the plague.
Yes.
Right?
I get it.
And
totally.
That is endemic across all these hives now that are going left and right across the country nonstop. Is we have you know, these malnourished immunosuppressed, you know, hives and apiaries that, you know, can literally be knocked over.
Like, it's similar to like not allowing crop rotation to happen, where the land sits for a period of time and is just able to like reabsorb nutrients.
Or why cattle farms have all these very unhealthy cattle, because they're in this pen,
small free space. Range. Yeah.
You know, of course it's diseased. Of course they need antibiotics.
Yeah.
Duh.
Yeah.
So it's endemic across our entire food system. So, you know, that again, it kind of backs up to like what I knew about farming growing up, and certainly the few cattle that my grandfather had, they were totally free range.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and why there were a few.
And then why there were few.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it was pastoral.
Yeah.
And boy, was that grass that, you know, they were pastured on, boy, was that grass healthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was a reason why that manure went back into the field and got tilled into the field, you know, at the end of the season. And, you know, the crops got moved around to something else, and he grew clover on that field until it was tilled in the next year.
And these are this is the kind of thing that I feel like where there's, you know, it comes back to our food. And it comes back to our relationship with nature and with the planet. We've completely lost this sense that we actually are getting fed by this planet and this solar system. You know,
yeah.
It's so hard for us, because we basically go from an enclosed home to an enclosed vehicle to a workplace to a grocery store, and this is our, you know, this is our trough that we kind of stay within. We don't even have a sense, unless we live in a rural area, or unless we're farming the land, unless we're like getting our hands dirty and seeing what's actually happening at the root level. We have no sense of this stuff.
Right. And I think even the people who are interested in it ends up being kind of, to use the word I was talking about earlier, an agroturismo, right?
Yeah.
It ends up being agriculture tourism. You know, it's very Portlandia-esque totally in terms of the people who act like they care.
Yeah.
And they're into it. And, oh, where is it from? What was the chicken's name, right? Like, you know, there's all of this kind of bluster about it. But, you know, then they go to a restaurant and they order whatever off the meal. And they're like, whatever, you know, it happens one meal a week that they care about. Yeah. You know, they're not really thinking about it. And look, we know how difficult life is.
Yeah.
Life's tough, and you know, people are busy, and you know, the agriculture system and the grocery system and the distribution system make it very easy to not think about that. And they don't want us to think about it.
And I think our you know, just the industrialized complex of our daily lives at this point is just pushing further and further towards like the my new pet peeve is productivity. Because I feel like
that's fascinating.
How much more productive? Like, how many more hours a day can I possibly spend being productive?
Sure.
Towards what?
Yeah.
You know,
I make a habit of walking through grocery stores, and so I drive an electric car, and I stopped today on my way back to the city, and I plugged in my car, and it was the place to plug in was right next to this Aldi supermarket.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I'd never been in one.
I know about them, I know where they're around.
I'd never been in them. I know that they're like, you know, from, I think that's it's a German grocery chain that originally was known for kind of Trader Joe's type.
Exactly.
You know, special, originally like Odd Lots, and they'd sell the dented cans, I guess, something like that. But I walked in there, and this is like the low end version of that. And everything was in a box, a package, plasticized, the romaine, if you would call it that, the meat, the fish was all vacuum packed and sealed. I mean, there wasn't anything. I mean, you couldn't smell anything. Mm-hmm. It was sterile.
Yeah.
It was sterile. And that is just so true of all of our food system now. And look, that's the extreme. But I do think that that's where the large majority of people, how they are shopping today, whether it's fresh or boxed,
even
they are buying sterile.
Yeah, and even the way we eat now. I mean, I think we've grown accustomed to sterile. Even if you eat salmon or chicken or whatever it is that is now the, if you eat chicken from a farm where this, you know, chicken ate grub worms and, you know, stuff out of the dirt compared to one that was from an industrialized shed.
Yeah.
It's got a smell to it. It smells like chicken.
Right.
And we don't want our food to smell like that. And you know, wild salmon smells fishy.
Yep.
It's supposed to smell like fish. Right.
And has a texture.
It's eating algae and, you know, stuff from the sea. That's right. That's what it's supposed to smell like.
It has a texture. You actually have to chew it.
Yeah. So the things that I was sort of attracted to when I was getting some of these newsletters were like, and this is one of these things I feel like, yeah, we're busy. We can't possibly, like, you know, pay attention to every aspect of all these things. We can't, you know, support every bee farmer and every, you know,
no, we can't
cause, but I think there are like little things that, and I just bought a house recently. So I'm like, I now have this yard that I'm like exploring and thinking about what am I going to do with this yard?
You going to get a beehive?
Well, but the thing that you had in your newsletter for B-Row was, you know, stuff about like sort of simple things that you can think about, like letting dandelions sort of, you know, come up and you can wait for that thing that we call the weed to flower and then take it out.
Sure.
I mean, simple. So tell me.
I mean, you know, it's very counter what, it's not sterile, right? It's very counter of the suburban mindset. And, you know, this is not to, you know, be down on the suburban mindset, but, you know, it's like everyone wants the perfect green lawn.
Yeah.
But that perfect green lawn is sterile and it's not good for the environment. Yeah. And it's definitely not good for bees.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, a couple of things you can do is, yes, let your, you know, stop using pesticides and fungicides and, you know, weed killers on your lawn.
Yeah.
Because it will, you know, those are killing pests that are good.
Yeah.
Those, you know, those weeds are natural and they're good and they
and
they,
bugs they, that birds eat and all these things
all
are
that
stay
stuff
around.
is really positive. You know, plant some wildflowers, some relatively indigenous wildflowers that just do their thing and bloom, you know, not just in the spring and not just, you know, at certain times of year, but, you know, plant, you know, a variety so that you're getting a, you know, mix of flowering plants all summer, you know, all season long.
Yeah.
And
the places that the bees, you know, burrow and the like having plastics underneath your...
Yeah, it's really bad. And so we're not just talking about honeybees in this case.
Right.
Like, we're talking about all pollinators, right?
There's
all kinds of natural bees that, you know, that bore into the soil that, you know, there's wood bees. There's all kinds of bees that, you know, when we plasticize everything, they don't have a natural place to live.
Right.
And it's just not healthy for the environment. So the same as
because you want
worms in the soil.
Exactly. Exactly.
you want natural bees flying around because they are natural pollinators. You know, they're pollinating everything around us, as well as that broccoli field and that pepper field.
Exactly.
And that strawberry.
So this guy's not carting bees around from place to place
trying to
get his crop to grow.
You know, so, you know, so that's, you know, a couple of things that, you know, people can do every day, all the time. You know, the things that we do is, you know, we work really closely with our beekeepers so that they are, you know, they have a list of kind of best practices that we've learned, you know, work really well over the years. And, you know, those are, you know, really working with them to find forage locations that are away from, you know, standard crops that, you know, are GMO, the pesticides are being used on.
Mm-hmm.
So we're either looking for wild floral sources or we're looking for organic floral sources. And obviously that's a lot healthier for the bees.
Yeah.
And we found that, you know, with our best practices and our beekeepers not trucking their bees all over the country, focusing on those floral sources, you know, for our specific floral types, we're able to pay them significantly more for their honey, and they are, you know, less dependent on a pollinator check.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
So they're making good money from their honey now.
Yep.
They don't have to truck their bees around, so their lifestyle gets better personally.
Yep.
Their bees are healthier, and we get a great crop.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the kind of the sustainable process that we do. And, you know, that's the next thing that consumers can do is, you know, look, it'd be nice if you could, you know, shop at a farmer's market every day.
Yeah.
But pay attention to a couple of things. You know, the things that you can control, you find vendors like ourselves that produce a product a certain way and stick with them because they need you. Like we need customers to come back.
Yeah.
You know, we're not just a gift. You know, we need customers to support what we do because we support what they do.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of what's beginning to, you know, really lack.
It's sinking in with the movement of organics. I mean, there's stuff happening.
The problem is that, you know, with everything, other problem we've talked about is that there's so little brand loyalty.
Yeah.
There's less and less brand loyalty. So it's like, we have to market constantly and bring in new customers.
Yeah.
Where if we had, you know, customers that came back twice a year consistently and bought and, you know, twice a year, even in small quantities, you know, that's more sustainable. And it's more sustainable for all businesses.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, find your olive oil that you like and is produced by a family farm. Find your maple syrup. Find your honey. Find your, you know, I just started subscribing to a wild sockeye salmon share, you know, and I get a, you know, like six fillets once a month, and, you know, I'm supporting a family of fishermen in Alaska who they're pulling the stuff in sustainably, freezing it themselves and shipping it. So I've got these guys out there who I'm now supporting and like find little things like that you can support. You know, it's like, of course you're not going to go taking a drive every weekend to the chicken farm.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
But if you can do a couple of things like that, you know, it really makes a difference.
And just follow your interest. I mean, if you find something that you know that you're really into one thing, just try to track that down to that, that level.
Absolutely.
I Before I knew we were going to meet, I had to dig into your website a little bit because I think I've seen maybe some of the videos and stuff that you've done before with cooking.
Yep.
When you had a little more hair, it was pretty awesome. But it was fun to see.
Folks, that's not to say that I'm bald. It's just that I had long hair at the time and now I have short hair.
It was a little bit.
It's not to say that
I was a little sideshow Bob maybe at that point. but it was cool because you did sort of like marry all these pieces of you that were like you're having like drinks in there with you know using what you have here. But with your sort of culinary skills.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, check it out, folks. There's lots of like great recipes on there for all sorts of things from like entrees, desserts, drinks,
cocktails.
It's
cocktails. It's super fun. I got to say that's my favorite part, you know,
and it's pretty. It's like, you know, all the colors of the, that's my favorite part.
Cocktails over the past couple of years has been that's been my like pet project is like creating honey cocktails. They're so much fun.
Yeah.
Everyone likes them.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're fun to create. They're pretty.
It's an easy sell.
It's definitely an easy sell. Well, and when we do promotional stuff, it's easy to like, mix a bunch of cocktails and bring them with us. And, you know, every once in a while wants to try a cocktail and that's easy.
What's your favorite honey of the varieties?
So in front of you, we have five honeys here. We usually carry
Colorado.
Yeah. So these are all specific floral sources from specific states. So we have, Florida orange blossom, Colorado, sweet yellow clover. I think you should try that first. Cause this like, so there's kind of like, people who grew up with honey either grew up like with clover honey because they kind of grew up in the north, in the Midwest and there's a ton of clover honey, or they grew up in California or Florida and they know orange blossom honey.
Okay.
And then there's, you know, some who like might've grown up in the South and they know Tupelo or something like that. But that's kind of it. The rest of us kind of knew like generic honey. But when you grew up in the Midwest, you knew clover honey. And when you taste our clover honey, the way it's produced and the way we manage it, it is so pure. And you get these like notes of butter and nutmeg and cardamom and just all these kind of exotic spices. And
that's very buttery.
Very buttery. And it crystallizes like that. And naturally, you kind of get this like round crystallization and this white creamy consistency that just doesn't happen. And that's, you know, part of the fun crystallization process and of each honey being different, because while it's the same in terms of each honey is the same in terms of its molecular quality, each honey also has different levels of moisture content.
Oh yeah.
The pollen itself that's in the honey is bigger, smaller, more of it, less of it. So
you can see it in like the North Carolina
sourwood
is like kind of like crystally.
It's crystallized, it's separating. You know, you get the meadow foam is extremely crystallized, almost like shaved ice.
Yeah.
You know, your orange blossom will be kind of this drier crystalline kind of square crystals. You get others that will kind of be more like shaved ice or like wet sand. But yeah.
And the color varieties are.
I find it fascinating. You know, sometimes people will get the honey and they'll be like, well, it's crystallized. Is it any good anymore? Like, in fact, it's best.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the crystallization shows that we haven't even talked about processing, right? We haven't talked about processed versus unprocessed, right? The fact that it's crystallized shows you that this is an unprocessed honey, that it is in its natural state.
Okay.
If they had been processed, they would have been it would have been heated up to 300, 400 degrees, forced through micro fine filtration to pull out all the particulate matter for the sole purpose of it not crystallizing on the shelf, because commodity
sterility.
That's right. Because the commodity business thinks that we all want that perfectly amber colored liquid
in a plastic honey bear,
right? Yep. I have this like dream of doing an advertising, this ad that's like a wanted poster with the honey bear on it, like wanted, like dead or alive, black and white, with the honey bear on it. But in fact, you know, raw honey that's unprocessed, it crystallizes. Each one crystallizes differently. So it has its own color, its own texture, its own flavor. And when it's crystallized, you know, you have these different senses on your tongue. You've got sweet and salt and bitter and sour.
Yeah.
And when it's completely liquid, it hits your sweet taste buds first.
Hmm.
So you get all the sweet, and then it dissipates very quickly off your tongue because it's liquid. It goes boom, and it's gone. Yeah. When it's crystallized, it has to melt on your tongue. So you get all of the other components of the flavor, not just the sweet. So, you know, it's in your mouth longer and you get all the savory notes and the sour and the bitter notes. And there's just so much more to it than sweet. And that's, you know, sweet is what most people experience when they, you know, taste the honey bear, which to me, you know, tastes like, you know, it's basically honey flavored sugar syrup. You know, it's not honey.
So is there one that you prefer, say, with like a tea or a...
Yeah, so I have preferences for tea, I have preferences for cheese, I have preferences for my miso glazed salmon recipe. So I generally go with lighter, more floral varietal, like a New York basswood for tea. The sourwood, which you're tasting right now.
It's like very light, but also it's very honey-y.
It's very honey-y. It's very floral. Like you get rose and like magnolia. You also get those buttery notes. And you get a little astringency out of it.
Yeah, a little more astringency. I think that's the light part.
Yeah,
of it.
Yeah. That's one of my personal favorites. It's a very rare honey. It grows in the Appalachians at a fairly high elevation. That's pretty moist.
Yeah.
So the bees aren't always flying when the blooms are blooming for the sourwood, but it just makes
it. It's almost really, kind of like lifts off your tongue a little bit.
And it keeps going, right? Yeah. Like it has a very long, you know, these are wine
totally
concepts, yeah. Right? It's a very long finish.
Yeah.
Just keeps going and opening up and just hanging out there. But like, that's fantastic with like,
there kind of like this one in particular almost has like that sense of what a fermented thing where it just kind of like lifts. You can kind of feel it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like in the air in my mouth now.
Right. Exactly. And, that's fantastic with like, you know, fresh camembert or a brie. This next one, which is this one's really interesting. We only recently found this a couple of years ago and, it's called meadow foam. And the reason it's called meadow foam is it's a flower that grows kind of a small bush. Maybe it gets about a foot high off the ground, but they grow it commercially for its seed, and its seed, they make an oil which is used in cosmetics. It's very good for the skin. But it grows in this kind of like small bush that's about a foot by a foot, and puts off these white flowers that cover the whole thing. And then like you have a field of them, and the field, like when the wind blows, it kind of undulates and it kind of gives it this foam look. So that's why it's called a meadow foam. But this is really interesting because it makes this honey that is what I would say is the most unhoney-like honey. Get notes of like cotton candy and creme brulee.
Yeah, it's like caramel. Cake. Like, yeah, cake and caramel. Carrots like caramel cake. It totally is.
I always taste cotton candy. You know, and it's almost unnatural to an extent. Like when I say cotton candy, like almost that sugar, caramel.
I can almost kind of understand. So is this the stuff that's good for skin? Is this kind that you use on skin, or is
I would use anything on skin. Any honey is good on skin. Meadow foam, the oil that they make out of the seed has nothing to do with the honey.
Yeah.
That's
interesting. That's just interesting flavor.
Yeah, it's interesting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't even like pinpoint it.
Yeah.
But definitely.
That goes really fantastic with like your mountain cheeses, like Gruyere.
But I could see it. I could see using it in baking or something too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's awesome. All right, I'm ready for the next one.
You're ready for the next one. Let's go back this way. And I'm going to have to get up and get another one because there's one more I didn't bring out that always throws people for a loop. And you know, so this is orange blossom, and I think, you know, orange blossom is one of those ones that people are familiar with, but when you taste one that's raw and unprocessed and well produced, you get oranges. You smell
I've never
orange
had it.
Blossoms.
I've never had it on. I've had it before, but not unprocessed.
If you've ever, I mean, you know, few of us have had the ability to walk through an orange grove and smell what it smells like.
Mm-hmm.
But that honey is what it smells like. The fragrance of the greenery of the leaves and the blooms of orange blossom. That's what it's like, and you don't experience.
And grittier now than the rest of it,
right?
Like just kind
right.
of like.
But you know, but because it's slow to melt in your mouth, mm-hmm. you get all those nuances.
Yeah,
you just don't get those when you've highly processed a honey,
right.
to make it liquid on the shelf.
It's almost sugary feeling in my mouth. It's
right.
kind of a different, but I can. It's got that like, but it's a very light citrusy thing. It's not like. Intensified in any certain
no, it's
way.
Not. It's yeah. I mean, it's a citrus smell. There's mm-hmm. no citrus taste, and there's definitely no sour. But it's that floral nature. It's the citrus floral. And that's what it is. Literally, is the nectar of an orange blossom.
That's good.
All right, I'm gonna grab one more.
Okay. You holding out on the Tupelo honey for me, or what's? I want to know why they were singing about it.
You want to know what?
I want to know why why
Tupelo is such a big deal.
Yeah, and why it was being sung about. If...
You've got me. Frankly, you've got me. You're like, it's great, and I'm sure you're going to get all kinds of nasty tweets because you have a million followers who listen to your show, and they're going to tell me I'm awful and I'm wrong and all that. But Tupelo, it's okay. It's good. It's a lovely honey. But to me, compared to what the ones you've tasted and the one you're going to taste, it's not, in terms of flavor, it's not so different. The one thing that, you know, really sets Tupelo apart is, you know, the fact that it, you know, if it's a good one, it never really crystallizes well.
Mm.
It stays liquid and
in its raw form, it stays this way.
Right. And this one, you'll even see that this one even does crystallize a little bit, and that's why we've actually never carried a Tupelo honey, is because they are very often counterfeited because it's made in very small quantities, very high price, and has this reputation. So we've never carried it before, and so this is our first time, and you know, it's not my favorite, but we should try it. Just so you know, you're getting into this is one of my favorites. So this is buckwheat.
The color of this one.
This is buckwheat. It's like dark brown, almost black. It looks like molasses. It tastes like a barnyard.
You're selling this one.
Oh, this is one of my favorite. We call it the Guinness of honey.
Hmm.
And this is a polarizing honey. Either people love it or they really don't like it. Like they can't get into it.
I like it.
I love it.
Because I'm not a big, for some reason, like I almost like a little smoky.
Yeah, and this is like, than, yeah, and this has got a lot of savory notes, a lot of herbaceous notes. It's got the barnyard going on.
It's got a little barnyard. It's
fantastic with like fresh ricotta or fresh chev.
I can see using this in a drink, actually.
It's great in coffee, actually.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I make a miso glaze with it that I roast salmon in, yeah. Which is out of sight.
I can totally taste that.
That is totally out of sight. Yeah, so if you add some salty stuff to it, it really like sets it off, sets all those earthy, savory tones. It lets them loose.
That's awesome. I definitely taste the barnyard, though.
Yeah, the barnyard is there. No joke. All right, I'll let you taste the Tupelo now, because you asked so nicely. Look, I love it. I love it. It's just to me, like things like sourwood and meadow foam, and even the yellow sweet clover are more interesting, more diverse than the Tupelo.
She's floral.
She's a lovely lady. I mean, she's lovely. Don't get me wrong. She's.
But I see what you mean. I mean,
it's a honey you would take home to mom, right?
That's right. I think maybe my new favorite might be
sourwood.
I think it's the sourwood or the. I really kind of liked the.
You like the craziness.
The meadow foam. Well, I will. I'm going to throw your website up on the on my website, but it's brawe.com. Is that correct?
It is brawe.com. BEERAW.com.
And there's some good videos of you doing some cooking on there. There's all the varietals that you have are on there, and lots of recipes.
Tons of recipes, as well as just great easy pairing suggestions.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think that's the biggest thing we get. It's like, what do I do with this? What do I put this with?
Yeah.
And the easy pairing suggestions are really the most, look, at the end of the day, not everyone wants to cook, but everyone's able to throw together a little cheese platter with a couple of interesting honeys, like super, super interesting. Everyone needs a cocktail, once a week, at least.
Yeah, at least.
there's some really easy options up there. And, even more importantly, we try to do a lot of good. I think that we try to do a lot of good. We are very sustainably minded and mission oriented. And
that's the way I think businesses need to go this way at this point.
Need to go this way.
And educate. And that's part of why I'm doing the podcast and why I wanted to talk to you, because in the conversations we've had, I'm getting just the surface, and I know that there's like so much more.
Oh my
more.
God, are we just talking about the surface? I just had one of my employees, my top lieutenant, just came back from 6 weeks in Costa Rica. He got to go, 4 weeks he worked and went to language school at night, went to Spanish school at night for a couple of hours, and then he went on vacation for 2 weeks. Who gets to do that? But that's what businesses should be doing. Yeah. Is like, he doesn't need to be here every day.
Yeah.
He is able to move the ball forward anywhere he is in the world.
Yeah.
And that's how businesses need to think, especially entrepreneurial businesses that can't afford to pay $150,000 marketing executive.
And these sort of huge benefits packages,
that's just not sustainable. And offering solutions like that, being creative, and not controlling of employees.
Yeah,
he's not an employee; he's a partner.
Yeah,
the same as way as my beekeepers are partners; they are not people who are just selling me honey.
Yeah, and if we could think about, part of what I'm getting at is that we are every aspect of our lives, whether we want to acknowledge this or not, is we live in these communities now that are spread out, but the fact that you and your beekeepers, wherever they are in the States, are all connected through this culture, you are a community. And, you know, how we treat each other and how we support each other, these are things that now can be done, you know, instantaneously across this spectrum of the internet that needs to be, like, really considered in the process.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the internet is there's a lot of good to be had, right? Like, we all consider, like, there's so many benefits. There's some detractors out there, you know, as well. But, like, you know, people are able to find us, and we are able to spread our story and spread our beekeeper stories and spread a lot of good via the internet. And that's a really good thing. You know, it's unfortunate that the internet's such a, you know, mind-numbing suck. Yeah. That it is as well. But there's a lot of good there, and we benefit from it for sure. We're able to share these stories, and that's a really positive, big positive.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you taking the time to do this, because I think there's a lot. We should maybe we can get into a little bit more depth of some subject matter, but I think, you know, if people want to learn a little bit more about what's going on in the bee community, and you want to understand how to support this, subscribe to the newsletter for Bee Raw. There's also you guys are donating a certain percent of proceeds from the honey. So support small suppliers like this, and and check out beeraw.com.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Yeah, thank you.
Fun.
Zeke Freeman, folks. That was my first taste testing on the podcast. We'll have to see if you, if there's something that sounds interesting to you on there. You can go check it out at beeraw.com. And don't forget, there are some amazing recipes in there and some great drink recipes for the summer. I love the way Zeke runs his business and gives thought to every aspect of it, from the bees to the beekeepers to his own staff. If we want to live in a better world, we have to be better to everyone and everything involved. Goodness is in the details. And if you want to keep what is good, you must support it, even if it costs a little more, as Zeke mentioned. Or eventually, we'll all live in a world that's even more overly processed than it's already become. And like Zeke mentions, find the things that you're passionate about, do the research, and find the most reputable and sustainable sources. With a lot of small businesses like Bee Raw, you can call up and talk to a real person and ask them questions you might have about their products or services, because they're often run by a very small team. Thanks for being the thoughtful person that you are. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet and all of our little bee friends who take care of us. Be well, my friends.